Welcome back to the Accelerators Podcast. We are radiation oncologists Drs. Matt Spraker, Simmel Parikh, and Anna Lauschus, and we're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. Note, the discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. And now, on with the show.
Hello, welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. This is Simmel Parikh, Medical Director at Lake Huron Medical Center, and I'm here in the studio with one of our hosts.
Matt Spraker. Yeah, I'm a radiation oncologist in Denver, Colorado, but I'm sitting right now in Port Huron, Michigan. I'm going to be speaking at Simmel's symposium later today, so we were able to do our first ever podcast in person, at least for a couple of us.
And I'm Anna Lauschus, a radiation oncologist in community practice in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, not in the same room as the other co-hosts.
And I'm Anna Paulson. I'm a radiation oncologist in community practice in Sonoma County, California.
Well, great to have you, Anna. We've met before in the past, and we've had some great conversations. I've always thought you'd be a great guest to have. And I think we've all interacted with you. And so I think the thing we talked about was a recent tweet that you had posted about Astro and about research. And we found it fascinating. I think it drew a lot of attention. It was radonk viral, at least.
small virus.
Small virus. Yeah. So why don't you introduce the tweet or kind of describe what your feelings are? And yeah, then we can kind of talk about it as a group.
Yeah, I can actually go pull it up. So it's tangentially related to how I got into medicine. So I got into medicine via working through the UCLA mobile clinic. And it was a free clinic that set up on the corner of Sycamore and Romaine in West Hollywood. And it basically gave free care to anybody who needed it, which is a huge population in Los Angeles. And then I sort of continued that when I was at Wake Forest in medical school and worked at their free clinic and actually started the mobile clinic at the Wake Forest School of Medicine, which was a similar principle, just giving free care to people who needed it. And so sort of healthcare inequity has always been a soapbox of mine. And while I did not go to Astro this year, so I have to put that disclaimer out there, a lot of what I saw through following the meeting on Twitter was really cool research. A lot of AI, a lot of technology, a lot of really things that will drive our field forward. But as somebody who works in solo practice in the community, and we can't even get a new Linac because we've had our capital expenditures frozen, it was frustrating to see all this cool stuff and know that so many of us will never have access to it. So I said, I've been following along Astro 2022 and can't help but think that some of the research being showcased furthers inequity in medicine. And some places have all the tech, AI, MR, Linac, protons, and certain patients can and will travel for that technology, whether or not it clinically matters. And I trained at UCSF and technology was big there. Technology is huge in the Bay Area. And so I do see a lot of patients who are like, well, do I need to go to UCSF or Stanford? And I was like, no, for this, you're fine. But it's a question I get a lot. And these same centers are likely to, these same larger centers are more likely to have a social worker, a registered dietitian, and mental health support for patients under treatment. And we know that that social support to get through treatment makes a big difference in how people tolerate treatment. It makes a big deal in how people get through treatment and whether they're even successful in completing that treatment to begin with. And so that will impact their cancer outcome. But what about everybody else? What about the hospitals who consistently have lower payer mixes who have to cut funding for ancillary services, which is what has happened at my group? And what about the rural hospitals who don't have the resources to give out taxi vouchers to help with transportation, which is also something we've experienced? And this technology is great. It drives the field forward, but it can also further the inequality to leave patients behind who can't even find a ride to treatment. And so I really want to challenge some of these bigger centers that have resources and that have all these cool things to make sure that this does not become another social determinant of health, because that's something we've seen, especially during the last 2 years, is that the health and wealth curves have continued to separate.
That's really, I mean, that hits the nail on the head. I mean, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree with this. I didn't frame it as nicely as you did, but I said some similar things. I think that we all have an interest in technology. I think part of being a radiation oncologist is a curiosity and excitement about new toys. I think that's part of what makes the field so stimulating and interesting. I sense that more recently, it feels like the headlining research is proton therapy, recently MRI, LINAC, other types of hardware and software that most of us will not get to see after we leave campus, after we leave training. And so what about the rest of us, as you said? And I think it's super important. It was interesting to see the highlighted sessions. And then, you know, I brought up in a separate point that there was this great bolus study, a randomized trial of whether you need bolus or not for breast cancer, for chest wall radiation therapy, which is something that's not proven. And we've been doing it for years. And finally, here's a randomized trial. And it's super practical and it makes a difference for the everyday doctor. And that's not highlighted anymore. And I don't know, like, that the over reliance and showcasing of high tech stuff is practical for a lot of us. And, you know, one idea might be to have like a plenary session for practical articles or something like that, practical research that is everyday oncology. Because I think they're leaving us behind, which means they're leaving our patients behind.
Yeah.
I thought what was really interesting about your tweet was the reception that it got. So we said mini virus. It definitely had a lot of likes and retweets for like us, you know, we're a pretty small field. So unless something's a very general topic, I thought the engagement that people had with what you said was a lot for how small the field is and just for being a very niche commentary, because, you know, obviously medical oncologists aren't going to care very much about this or things like that. And I get the feeling that a lot of people feel this way, but it's not really openly talked about that much. And just to kind of add to that point, I recently changed from probably a job that had access to like all basically every technology now I'm just in, it's not really probably fair to call it a small community practice because I'm part of a big hospital network that will have some of these resources, but I'm being on the other side of it now, where I still have people that come in and they ask, hey, should I go look into proton therapy, that kind of thing. And it's, you know, when you actually sit and talk with the patients about it, they seem to really understand that benefits in many contexts are probably incremental. And so one thing that I took away from your tweet was just that I can understand why there's not motivation to focus on the incremental gains by some of these technologies, but I think it is something that might help our field to be a little bit more honest about that. Just because I think that patients are getting the wrong idea about some of these things.
Yeah. I think that it's how things are marketed and how things are advertised, because that's what catches people's eyes. It catches someone's eye when they see a billboard on the freeway. And I don't live in the closest proton center to us is in Southern California. And so we don't get their local advertising. But I can imagine that it probably exists down there. And so patients want the best. And we have a lot of really savvy patients. There's a lot of places that you can go read about the technology. And so when you have a patient who's really informed come in and ask all these really, really kind of thoughtful questions, the advertising and sort of how we market some of our technology, just, it seems like it's missing the point.
Yeah. I think one other thing that I found really interesting is that people that were interacting with it, you're naturally, a lot of people started to broaden what you said to other sort of inequitable ways that we spend money as a society and talk about who accepts care and who doesn't and things like that. And that was one of the other things that has been definitely true with my personal experience working at training at a center that was a state hospital, that was a safety net hospital. going to residency at a place that was not a safety net hospital and then working similarly. And then now back to a place where we do take kind of everyone. Mm-hmm. It's funny because the centers that I've been at that have the most resources seem to be the ones that are the most restrictive in who that they would let you see. And I feel like that a lot of people have said that it resonated with that aspect. And that's the other issue that makes it a little anger inducing, right? Because if you're a center that has all this technology and you're pushing the field forward, so to speak, at least on the stage at Astro, you'd assume that you'd then go home and offer this technology to everybody. And that seems to not be the case at most centers or many centers.
Yeah. I mean, I've only ever worked, I guess, at safety net hospitals because UCSF is attached to the county hospital, but there's a huge income and a disparity in San Francisco. So we saw really like both ends of it. And it was really stark. And then now working in Sonoma County, we are technically the default county hospital because the other providers around us are Sutter and Kaiser, and they can turn whoever they want away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having practiced multiple places now, I found it that the two jobs I had that were at nonprofit hospitals ended up becoming more restrictive with regards to indigent patients. While my current practice is at a for-profit hospital, but we are formerly a Catholic system and we continue to treat everyone. We take everybody and we have to figure it out. And my private practice and my first job, same thing. They walk in the door, they have cancer, we're going to figure it out. And I think a lot of us feel that way. Like if we weren't restricted by our the bureaucracy or the institution we work with, we will do what we need to do. Like nobody's so, money hungry that they wouldn't treat an indigent patient with cancer. And I know like personally the Radunks are like that, but the systems themselves don't allow it at times. And it creates that moral injury that we talk about.
Right. And I mean, even in the system that we work in is we're trying to figure it out, but we have fewer and fewer resources. So when you compare our payer mix, like, so there's, I work for Providence. And so Providence is the big kind of umbrella organization under which our medical group operates. And so we accept everybody, whereas Kaiser and Sutter don't, like I said, but because we have that lower payer mix, we have more Medicare, we have more Medi-Cal patients, and we don't have as many private insurance. And so we have less revenue and we're constantly getting things cut. Like they really are pretty careful about how we give out taxi vouchers. And I had a patient who needed dental extractions and it was a real challenge to get him in for care. And so it's like, not only do we have to figure it out, but we have to figure it out with tighter and tighter purse strings.
Yeah. It's a big challenge. I actually, it's funny because I was paying close attention to that as well. And I think that's what happens in most systems. I've been lucky so far that my system is also a Christian based kind of system, and they're much bigger and they seem to have highly value those things. Right. So despite the fact that our payer mix is kind of similar, we seem to have a lot of resources that are for supportive care, which is actually something that when I was going through this new job search, I was kind of searching for a place that valued that stuff, because I agree with you that a lot of systems often cut those things first because they don't view them as being revenue generating or things like that. But they're so important to get cancer patients with cancer through treatment.
And Alausis, what do you think that we can do organizationally or research wise to kind of help promote the health of everyone, not just patients going to the to the large academic centers with all the toys? Any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what's been discussed, and I think that a lot of it has to do with resource allocation. So, rather than concentrating it kind of with all of the fancy and flashy technology, really focusing on practical issues, getting patients to treatment. It's not necessarily, the sexy thing to do, but it's really what makes a difference for patients. So, in terms of like on an individual scale, I know that can be challenging, but yeah, I think, whether it's kind of at the leadership level of various organizations, but I guess understanding that all of the supportive care and transportation, the things that really assist patients with getting kind of the highest quality care, that's really the focus. And I think, you know, defining, I think the other element, just thinking about the conversation, you know, thinking about high quality care and kind of what that means, you know, does it mean getting kind of the latest, you know, technological advance that might be just an incremental gain, you know, perhaps not. And so I think just, you know, thinking, you know, really in a concerted way about that. And when I trained at Michigan with the MROC consortium, one of the things that we looked at was, you know, it was a big group of, you know, I think it's now up to in the 30s, but at the time I was there in like the 20s for different institutions throughout the state of Michigan. And, you know, really defining metrics for, you know, what quality means and kind of holding institutions accountable to that. I think that's one of the ways that that we can achieve that. Because, yeah, I think when you leave it up to just individual institutions, they might just look at the bottom line and not necessarily the value that's added to patient care. So those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, I put it when I think I can't remember if I put it. This came up a couple times recently on Twitter, so I can't remember if I responded with this to your thread or to a different one. But this whole conversation made me think about the NCCN has a program where they do resource stratified kind of recommendations. And the reason they did this originally, I believe, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but the way that I heard it was I thought that they did this because they know around the world, the guidelines are used by all kinds of centers. And some centers do, like, they have no access to many of the things that are recommended. So what they did is they kind of stratified out, like, you know, what's really, really important? What is it that gives you a huge gain in survival for the cost or for the resource? And then what's more of an incremental kind of aspirational thing? So, like, I was looking through the breast one, and just as an example for listeners that haven't read it, like, things that are considered to be huge gains for the cost is like Herceptin, for example. So that's, you know, it's challenging to deliver, but they think it's worth it. So, you know, centers should try to set that up. But then probably an incremental gain is like a breast MRI, for example. So they kind of really separate out the things that make, you know, that make huge gains and improvements. And what's funny is that in radiation oncology, or at least from Astro, is we have, you know, we talk about inclusion and equity all the time. And then we also talk about this technology, but to me, there's like a disconnect there. And I think it would be really powerful to just openly recognize that, especially in the stuff that's sort of lay person facing, where these technologies do have benefits, but it's important to be clear that they could be benefits that, for example, push the field forward, or in the more abstract way, maybe less have direct impact on patient outcomes today. And so that way it can be a little more clear about what's really important and what's not.
Yeah. And I think what's would be missing, and that's where, I mean, I hate using the word missing because then it's kind of putting the blame on somebody, but it's missing. Like, that focus is what's missing, is like, hey, we know that there's all these inequities, and we know we're trying to talk about this diversity and equity and inclusion, and it just feels like the message is not consistent with what people say our goals are. Like, what we're actually doing is not aligning with what people were saying.
Because it's really easy to say things like that about equity, and it's very hard to walk the walk. It's very hard to actually behave in a way that's promoting equity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's my frustration with it, is that it's talked about so much in such superficial ways, and instead of actually taking actions to make it more equitable. I you know, we talked about it before we started taking this PPS exemption. Yes, it's only $500 million. Yes, it's only a few institutions. Yes, it only talks about a few percent of patients, but many, many patients have heard of Sloan Kettering. Many, many patients have heard of MD Anderson. And when everything is direct to consumer advertising and you have the fanciest toys and you also get paid much more than the community center to use those toys, it is completely creating a two-tier system. There is the haves and the have-nots. And don't get me wrong. Like, if I was sick, I'm going to go to a big center. Like, I have the resources and I'm going to do it because I understand that it is a tiered system. And maybe that wording that you said is social determinant of health. Maybe it is that the access to big cancer center is an actual social determinant to health. And that would be kind of sad that these folks train us to be amazing radiation oncologists, but we're not able to provide a similar level of care, or at least a perceived similar level of care.
And maybe within the actual radiation treatment and in the actual chemo or immunotherapy treatment, maybe all of that part is the same or just as good. But what you're missing is that social worker who can help connect you with a therapist, or that dietitian who can really figure out what you're missing in terms of nutrition to help get you through treatment. Or maybe some places even have a therapist. I mean, I know that UCSF does have a dedicated psycho-oncology and integrative health department. And we're in the Bay Area. There's a little bit of woo. People are really, really interested in that. And I'm not knocking them for having it. I think it's great. But it's really, those things make the cancer center more comprehensive in terms of delivering patient care and making people's experience as they go through one of the scariest things in their life not as scary.
Yeah. I think a little bit of it also to me, I mean, I agree with both of those things, but what really sticks out to me is also kind of what Anna Lausch has said about quality indicators, right? So we also don't do a very good job of describing, even to our referring physicians, about what makes a quality radiation treatment, right? And I'm not sure that anyone really knows. This has been something I've been like asking about since training, and I keep kind of bringing it up that like we don't have good, we have some, but not great indicators of what makes a quality treatment. So I'm sort of like you, where I actually don't have intense competition over technology because there's not a proton center in Denver. So that, you know, that's, we don't, this doesn't come up very often, but what I do see constantly is advertisements that one center, the center that, you know, that is the university, says that they have better than average outcomes in the state. And to me, it goes to, it's, to me, it's misleading, right? Because as the outcome from the quality of treatment, where internally, technically, as radiation oncologists, we have trouble describing what makes that quality, or is it because of their payer mix, right? And they just don't take the patients that have the covariates or factors that we know sort of are associated with worse outcomes, likely from socioeconomic, you know, determinants of health. So I think that part is what I think gets to the core of this issue, that it does feel a little bit like a two-tiered system because of these way that things get sorted out with the differences in policies.
And I mean, people who are disadvantaged present with more advanced cancer to begin with. So there's that as well that's factored into it.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear a little. So do you, in your own, center, like, I mean, this is something that you've been kind of working on for your whole career. So have you had success, in your center kind of trying to build up some of these programs to support these patients better, or how do we go forward from here? That's the question I always have.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great, I don't know. I mean, I have not really had much success with that. When I joined this group, I basically brought body radiosurgery with me. So before I joined this group, they were only doing stereotactic treatment in the head. So, I mean, when I joined the group, there's a lot of people who don't have to travel to San Francisco now, which is great. And is what really kind of, when I'm having a rough day at work, keeps me here. Because I mean, parking's $24 a day there. It costs a lot of money. And it's not free parking. And the bridge toll is like $9 now. So it costs a lot of money just to get into the city. And so the fact that we're able to deliver care here without people having to navigate one-way traffic and road closures, I mean, that's a lot. And I treat patients from Sonoma County all the way up to, I think the closest radio surgery center to me is where Joy Lou practices. So up in Eureka. So I have a really big catchment center as far as I treat Sonoma County, Mendocino County, Humboldt County, Lake County. So we have a really big catchment area as far as radio surgery goes. So we have successfully done that, but we don't have really anything else. I think our oncology group has tried to open like sort of an inpatient hospice, and that was not financially approved. And we've currently been struggling with some other kind of financial cuts, which have like basically put a halt to being able to develop anything new. And yes, whether that's because of COVID or whether that's because of the system, I don't know. I mean, COVID hit and I've been here almost the entire time since I graduated in 2018. So there wasn't that much time I was working here before COVID hit.
And it's interesting because I think it's hard to quantify, but I think that's a really good example. My guess is you probably feel like that was quite rewarding to bring body stereotactic radiotherapy to your center.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of patients tell me like, I'm so happy I don't have to drive to San Francisco. I'm like, I hear you.
Yeah.
So I think that was a really huge, huge gain for our group. And now the kind of ongoing challenge right now is upgrading our linear accelerators. We have a true beam that was supposed to have gone in almost a year and a half ago at the center in Santa Rosa, which is about 20 minutes north of me. It still hasn't gone in, and we were slated to get a new linear accelerator at my office, I mean, in 2023, but now we've kind of found that that's not happening. And so it's those like, wow, it's like we have all these people with all these cool toys and we can't even just get our linear accelerator upgraded.
Is it an internal issue or supply chain problem?
It's an internal issue. And there's probably a lot more to it than I understand. So I probably shouldn't speak that much more about it. It's an internal issue.
So yeah, I mean, we are in the process of obtaining another linear accelerator as well for our second facility, and I'm hearing everybody's having trouble getting true beams. Mm-hmm. We're talking 12-15 months.
Yeah.
And one of the options is to change to a Halcyon.
Mm-hmm.
And to that get the machine in sooner.
Yeah.
And so I know this is like cynicism or paranoia, but I wonder if like the big centers are getting their true beams on time and the rest of us are having to take Halcyons because yeah, we need something to get our patients treated. And yeah, then there's another point of saying, oh, well, they don't have as good of a machine as we do. And I'm nervous, like, cause I'm thinking maybe we will consider Halcyon, but then will the competitors say, well, that we have a true beam that's better and they're not able to do everything we can.
And that is a question that I get. Like people know about the true beam.
Yeah. Yeah, I had someone the other day. I was doing a consult for brain radiosurgery, and I had the patient had a huge family in the room, and I'm like talking, and then out of nowhere, one of the friends said CyberKnife, and I was like, oh, we don't have it, you know. And it took basically 5 minutes to explain that we don't have a CyberKnife, but we have a true beam, and we have a system that works very similarly, and it doesn't really matter what the technology is. You want, you know, a system that does a lot of it. And it goes back to like the beginning point, is there is this push and pull. And I guess my, my sort of desire would be to have a little bit more of a nuanced discussion that maybe, you know, it's not technology in itself is not going to push outcomes ahead substantially for most patients and most indications. And it's maybe a little less about the technology and more about the quality of treatment. And I don't hear a lot of that directed outward outside of our field, right? Despite our stated interest in making things more equitable across the country.
That's not hard to do. That's like a very easy thing to do, kind of make a statement and kind of make that sort of a push. It's not hard to do.
Well, I would say like on an individual level, ignore the institutions. Individually, Radonks are so collaborative and kind to each other when it comes to asking for help or like, hey, I'm doing this treatment, I haven't done it before. You can email or message somebody or call somebody and gosh, they'll let you talk to their physicist. They'll talk you through a case. They'll zoom through some images. And I find it like personally, if I need help, I can call anyone in Michigan, any of the big centers, and they will help me out and they'll do it, you know, out of their own time and kindly. But that's different than institutionally. And yeah, that's that's kind of the hard part, because I know my colleagues and my friends and all these folks that we've interacted with on social media and otherwise at conferences are more than willing to help you. Heck, they'll even, some of them, you know, if they're in the area, they'll come out to your site. Mm-hmm. You know, Spraker's talking about teaching the world how to do lattice treatments. And it's not to get rich, it's to spread a treatment that is beneficial to patients. And I think there has to be something more than the individuals doing it out of their own time. If the institutions would be as, I don't know, interested in collaborating in a way that's not just to monetize something, but to right. just say, hey, here's the knowledge, this will improve outcomes in our state, and we're committed to doing that. And I think, and Lash just kind of mentioned MROC, kind of has that goal in mind, I think, in Michigan. But I think it can be there. Like, if the faculty believe it to be important, then the institution may believe it to be important too, to improve outcomes throughout the state. And that you don't have to go to UCSF to get the best outcome. But we know that UCSF is amazing and that we're going to send our challenging patients there. And to know that there's an open communication when we need help, we're more than happy to.
Right. And I think that just kind of speaks to the importance of developing those relationships, regardless of where in this country you are, developing those relationships with the local specialists and having that communication. So it's like, yeah, we collaborate. I mean, we work for different areas, but we do collaborate and we do talk about cases. And I think that just goes to the importance of having that good relationship between the academic and the community radiation oncologist, which is, I know, something that you've talked a lot about. And maybe we aren't able to share all resources, but it's just that communication, that collaboration is really key. And as a institution and as an Astro, as in a society, it would be great to hear some support for that.
Yeah, and I think yeah. I think another approach to that could even be, you know, or at least, you know, being in community practice now, one of the things I've seen is, you know, referring patients to centers that have, you know, whether it's like interstitial brachy or something, you know, beyond, you know, what I'm able to offer, then having those big centers, you know, send the patients back for follow-up and kind of, you know, continuing the patient's care. So, you know, that's, you know, one approach that, you know, kind of like in the vein of, you know, sharing patients, like acknowledging that different centers have different levels of expertise. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, still maintaining the roots in the community. You know, one example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's something I do a lot as well. And I guess I have the advantage of I trained not too far from where I currently work. So I do still know a lot of the faculty there, but that's something we do a lot with prostate HDR. But not everybody has that advantage. Not everybody knows their local academic center that well. But that may be a way to kind of foster these local groups so that you can talk and kind of communicate with people on a regular basis to develop that respect and know that, hey, that person does do really good work.
One other thing that I thought was interesting, you had someone respond that asked about from the perspective of industry, mm-hmm. So like, how can they help? Is it an industry problem? You know, is this even there? Even to something that they should think about. There wasn't a lot of back and forth on that, but it made me think of, we had an episode a little while ago now where we had some industry folks on to talk about workflow, and Sasha Mudick was on from Varian. And one of the things that he spoke a lot about was about rapidly or building technology to greatly decrease the amount of time it takes to go from meeting a patient to treating them. And that's something that inherently is improves access. I think that that's, setting aside the question of whether you can afford the technology or it will be affordable to a lot of centers. I think when he was talking about it in his head, or at least he kind of explicitly said, he was talking about globally. So even lower resource countries, they might benefit from this kind of a technology. But one thing that really I thought that industry could do a better job on is just fostering knowledge sharing. I always blame Epic for this. It's my biggest complaint. I know that they have venues for this, but it's not like I don't know if you use Epic in your center, but it's not common that two centers that are using Epic are sharing ways that they're making their workflows more efficient. I just don't see that commonly happening. It does occasionally, but these big entities, Astro, Varian, Mavion, other big companies, I think that they could probably do a little bit of better job supporting knowledge sharing and disseminating some of these new technologies out to the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think that big companies can do, and we see that on the medical oncology side, is provide patient care grants. And we see that all the time from like when patients have a drug that they're going to be prescribed that costs $26,000 a month. It's like, okay, here's some financial assistance for that. So you're really not going to have to pay that much out of pocket. And I think some of the bigger companies on our side could do a little bit of that and have these, maybe they don't have to be big. If you're just looking for a patient care grant for dental extractions, that doesn't have to be a ton of money, but have them available and really easy to apply to. So it's not like this prolonged process where it takes weeks or months to get something going. It's like, hey, I don't know if they'd be willing to put money towards that because it would kind of hit their bottom line, but it would mean a lot towards kind of, hey, we support patient care and we also do this for people who are in need.
Yeah. I wonder if
it's hard to come by patient care grants.
It's an interesting question. I can tell you outside of oncology, my wife has a chronic disease and has a home biologic that she takes. And I had a conversation with her doctor about this. There is a competitive motivation to provide some of these services for pharma because they view it as a new space that they're competing in. So with her specifically, he was telling me that they have these concierge services that make sure the drug gets delivered exactly where you want it and making sure you're home so it can go straight in a fridge and all this stuff. But they also provide financial support, even if you're insured, right? Because the copay is so expensive for some of these drugs that they don't expect people to pay out of pocket. But the doctor was very honestly telling me, this is a doctor that, you know, consults with them and everything. He was just telling me that they do view it as a space to compete. And so I guess the question is if in our industry, if the radiation oncology companies have that same motivation, I don't know that there's a ton of people doing these programs out of the goodness of their heart, as I guess I would say. So, right.
Well, yeah. For tax breaks, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. And it looks good. I mean, it does look good for sure. So I think that their argument was just that if you're like the easiest one to work with, and if the patient feels like, oh, this is so easy, everything just is seamless and it works for me, then the doctor might be more likely to prescribe this drug versus a competitor. That was the motivation there. Yeah,
absolutely.
There's, we're working on something here. We are a small center we don't have our own surgical specialists. And we reached out to Henry Ford Health System, and essentially they had me meet with every specialist surgery team. And then we signed an agreement to do some data sharing, and that gave us access to present our patients to their tumor boards, which is like, I don't know that they understand how helpful that is to us, because we're Epic, they're Epic. We're able to send the reports, send images by courier if we need to, or digitally. And I can present a case just like another Henry Ford faculty member would. And they're also teaching us, when is appropriate to send for ViewRay. Like I can possibly do ablative pancreas, but I bet they can do it better, honestly. And I know that now I can call the other Parikh at Henry Ford and say, hey, can you take care of my patient? And the idea is, from the community outreach person, that they also want patients to get care closer to home. And if they have a trusted, valued partner, we can do that. And they've been sending patients, and it's been working out very well for us. And we did it without having to pay money, and they don't pay us. And it's just like a simple data sharing agreement and idea that we can help people in the state of Michigan. And I think that it felt good. It's been a good relationship for the last several months. I think it's helpful. I have been trying to do that with the other Michigan programs and have met resistance, but at least we have this going and it helps our patients. And I can tell them, hey, I might not know this, but the Henry Ford doctor will. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to discuss the case with them. And I think things like that are a win-win for everybody involved. And most importantly, the patient, you know, that I think that's
and it's a tumor board set up for that sort of collaboration to begin with.
Yeah.
An awkward pause.
It's okay. We cut out awkward pauses. Or we'll keep the awkward pause.
I mean, honestly, right now we've sort of lost a lot of our radiology support because the radiology group we were contracted with has, I don't know what happened. But we currently have no tumor boards except for a breast tumor board. So I'm like, that idea sounds pretty attractive right now because we don't have the radiology support for the tumor boards and the rest of the body.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, tumors are really important. I think an issue here is that because it's a smaller center and we're not doing tumor board every week, mm-hmm. we end up presenting retrospectively. There is a benefit for us and for the larger centers to partner with us to discuss these cases, because I've also worked in another rural area back at the early part of my career, and we were having that same issue with presenting cases retrospectively rather than prospectively. And it took a lot to get everybody to get on the same page with that. But I think without prospective case evaluation, we're not going to have optimal management, especially of tricky cases, but even routine cases, it helps.
So when you were a ret, so I'm gonna actually get to pivot a little because I want to try to squeeze this in since it's kind of on topic. There was another paper that was kind of floating around and being discussed that looked at one of our favorite topics, the workforce. But they looked at one of the take home messages was that there's some concern that rural jobs are not filling, right? So the concern is there might not be access to a radiation oncologist if these jobs are not considered to be desirable, or if there's not ways to get people into these jobs. And so my one question I guess I had for you is, when you were training, and I don't know if you plan to end up away from San Francisco, I don't know if you would consider your center to be rural or not. We actually separately were talking about that definition. It's sort of hard to define it, but did you feel like there was, like when you were talking, gearing up, getting ready for a job, was there motive? Was there acceptance of this kind of a position, or were people wanting you to go more into academics? Or,
that's a great question. So, my whole family lives in the Bay Area except my little sister. So this is home for me. And so I kind of went into the job market of, this is really, 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 really where I want to be. And so I was pretty narrow minded in my job search, as far as location goes. And the area that I work with, it's suburban, but there's a really big catchment area. So the town I work in, Petaluma, and Petaluma is a small, it's a small ish town. It's where Lagunitas Brewing was founded. So I'm actually a mile down the street from the Lagunitas headquarters. But there's a lot of farmland, and that farmland sort of extends for miles and miles and miles all the way out to the coast and then towards the Central Valley of California. So the town of Petaluma itself is suburban, but we have a big population of farmers and agriculture workers, and we're just south of wine country. And so that area actually gets to be fairly rural. So I don't think I would define the center as rural. I define it as suburban, but we do have a pretty large rural catchment area. And then sort of thinking about my job focus, there's always pressure to go into academics. I think there just is. My program director was incredibly supportive of, I made my what I wanted to do very clear from the get-go. And he was very supportive of that. And I did, was able to take some time kind of off the radar, like meeting people in various practices throughout the Bay Area, spending a day here and there during my elective months, but it was sort of under the radar. But he was very supportive. I just didn't kind of openly talk about it to everybody.
Yeah, I think I'm now remembering that we sort of chatted about this over text prior when we were kind of planning this show. The reason I ask is because I think this is another angle to kind of come at this issue, where I wouldn't say that I was given a bad impression. Like no one was saying like, don't go work at these centers, but I definitely had a little bit of an ivory tower effect in training where like people kind of would talk like high volume, big centers with technology, like really in practice do better treatment. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's very unfortunate that I didn't like learn that that's kind of a lie until I graduated residency. And I don't know if it was any one person's fault. You definitely cannot blame the PD. We had, I think I was saying over text that the GME office in my institution was incredibly anti-private center. Like, so you couldn't rotate at a private center because they were worried that because they were for profit, it would be like abused, like the residents would be abused, which is a rich statement looking back today. But basically that's that, you know, so you get these like hints of it. And then when I graduated, I did go to an academic center that was also big, but I did locums a couple of times at a very rural center. And I just, it's, what's funny is that it's such a different picture than was painted to me, or at least maybe I formed on my own with these hints. Because again, it's like, it's all these places are mostly good doctors trying really hard to give great care to their patients, but they're just hamstrung by access issues. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and I feel like once I learned that, I had a much more holistic view of how things really work in oncology. And I just wonder a little bit if the educational pathway is pushing some of these biases forward that end up with you feeling like how you did at the beginning of the show, which is like talking about, is all this technology really making access disparities and not necessarily pushing the field forward?
Yeah. And I mean, I think a subsequent tweet, probably in a different thread that kind of came up over the last week, is allowing residents to do those rotations. Yeah. I think it's really important. And regardless of whether you intend to go into community practice or not, you would serve to benefit. You'd learn a lot from rotating at a community. And maybe it doesn't have to be for a whole month. Maybe you've got financial constraints or family constraints and you don't want to go live somewhere for another month to do a whole rotation. But I think it would be very valuable to learn, okay, how does DOCI do it? How do you work with just remote DOCI? How do you work with a physicist who's not on site all the time? And I think that would be really valuable for resident learning, and then kind of open your eyes to, okay, well, maybe I should think about a different career pathway. Like maybe I hadn't thought about all my options as far as what to do when I graduate.
That's the other thing too, is that I think when I left residency, I felt like the path towards, this is going to sound so naive and ignorant, but the path towards like being happy is like academic success in the traditional definition, right? So like publishing or sitting on a committee or whatever. And more over the last several years, you know, it's so fulfilling to be a very active member of a local hospital. And like, and I see these doctors that are just like, you know, they're like all stars of their community and they seem really enriched by that and very happy with it. The patients love them. And that's just so fulfilling. And that whole like picture of a career was never, ever painted for me during my training.
And I don't think you're alone in that. Sometimes I still feel that way because I'm solo in my office. I was like, oh, it'd be really cool to be at an academic center where I'd be able to work with my friends. I mean, I think about that. I mean, I still have a lot of friends at the local academic center. I was like, oh, that would be really cool. And so I think we are sold that bill of goods that the only way to kind of feel fulfilled and successful is to do something like that. And I think we just need to open that up. And open that idea up to residents, be like, hey, you can be successful. You can have a great career through multiple different paths. And maybe one of those paths is working in the community and really working towards getting patients access to care that they wouldn't already have.
Yeah, there's great examples. I mean, I think I'll name drop by one of our local Detroit area docs. His name's Tom Boyke. He is a fascinating redneck. He is in a private practice. He enrolls more patients on studies than I think anybody in the entire state. He does work with industry. He does research. He is a busy clinician. And I think like he's a jack of all trades and he's doing this in suburban Detroit and getting paid pretty well. And he doesn't really have to deal with some of the university stuff that can be frustrating at times for faculty. And there are these great opportunities and people that are taking advantage of, the more I interact with docs, I'm realizing that radoncs can be very entrepreneurial. They can be very collaborative and do all kinds of interesting things, but we don't get exposed. And how do you, you know, like a kid doing a resident doing a rotation with Boyke, gosh, they would learn a lot. Like I would really think that'd be great. I think that I've gotten to spread my wings a little bit and do some fun things. I generally have the last year and a half have had students, and I've had, you know, a chance to do some writing and this podcast. And I think that the exploration of these careers, like it isn't as, there's not the two lanes, and they're not as separated as one might think. They're academic right. people that are doing way less academic things than even Spraker is doing right now at a community center. And then there's community, you know, it just overlaps a lot. Like there's just a lot of overlap, and people are learning more. I think people are aware that it exists now, but.
Or if what I mean, it's like, even if you would have asked me 10 years ago, are you a successful radonc if you just have a moderately busy practice and then you go home every day and you're like a great parent and you have you're really involved in your community, even outside medicine. So you volunteer or you go with a church or things like that. Like, I don't know that I've ever been told that that's like, okay. And that's success, right? In a training setting. And so I had to learn that myself. And now it's like, again, looking back, some of the happiest people that find themselves to be the most successful are ones that are doing that kind of stuff. And so, yeah.
Yeah. And I think just hearing something like that from a mentor or from your program director or just from a senior resident will go a long way, because it's perfectly okay to do something like that. It's if that's what you find fulfilling and you're involved, maybe you coach your kid's soccer team, and that's okay too. Like, you do good work, you take good care of your patients, but then you also kind of have that outside. And I think hearing that from a mentor or somebody you respect will go a long way towards making residents feel like, hey, I can pursue what path I want.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think some of the larger residency programs sort of have satellite rotations that mimic the community. I did one at UPMC at St. Margaret's, which is across the river. It was a community practice. It felt like a community practice. They were very tied in, and the attending was the assistant program director, but it was a community practice. You saw everything, you treated everything, you had a little bit less resources. So making those more available, you know, Arrow might want to consider like bringing that up as a topic, or if there's not specific rotations at programs, we can have volunteer faculty that will host the resident. I'm sure there's many out there that would really enjoy a month or two with a PJY5 from somewhere. I think these are kind of interesting opportunities to, again, continue to join and like connect the tower and the rest of us, because there's a lot to be offered both directions.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Like, the arthritis stuff is, you know, this is flowing the opposite way. This is one thing in radiation arthritis stuff is coming from the community. And the academics are learning from us. They're calling us. They're calling us on how to do it and how to do the billing. And we're happy to share. And it's great. It's great to be able to offer that in that direction. And we look up to them, and we want to learn from the academics as well. But we gotta join more, I think, and collaborate more. There's some good opportunities.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else to add in the last couple minutes here? We have to go teach a symposium to community medicine.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. Here I am.
That's actually something I've done, is I've given a couple of talks to my medical group. I think I have one coming up in the spring, is like teaching the primary care doctors about some of the radiation stuff. My one in the spring, I'm actually going to do the arthritis. I'm going to jump off the malignant sphere.
You're talking
to the benign conditions.
I'm giving system-wide grand rounds about radiation for benign indications in December. So we should definitely chat. I'm happy to share any of the materials I developed for that. But yeah. I think it's great. I agree with you. I think it's probably a topic for another day. But I think doing, especially if you're a solo radonc inside a hospital or connected to a system, I think doing talks to just like make people aware what we actually do, because people have weird ideas about our field. So I think giving those talks is great for any rad-onc to do. Yeah.
And it's way less intimidating because nobody's going to like nitpick you about the physics of what you do.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's a kind of, you know, the Matt's here in town for, he's going to give a talk on some radiation techniques, but we have like a proton person coming. We have like an academic medical oncologist from Cleveland Clinic who's going to talk about some things. And it's a small community, but why shouldn't we have access to this in our backyard occasionally instead of always having to travel somewhere to hear speakers? Again, this is the value of these connections that we can make, that you have people that are willing to do this and to jump on a Zoom and give a lecture or come in person and give a lecture.
You're so right, by the way. They're easier too. There's no like questions as comments or comments as questions, right? Or like the stuff that happens at conferences, people genuinely want to learn and they're very appreciative that you like are there talking, which is always really fun, I think.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us. I think it was fun to talk about this topic. I know people feel very strongly about it, so I think it'll be a well-received show.
And hopefully it'll give us a launching point to kind of collaborate about what to do. So now we got to figure out what to do. And we need to kind of get a lot of really smart people together because we've got so many smart people in our field. And I think that we would come up with a good solution about what to do about it.
Yeah, I agree. It's always the harder part.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, everybody have a great weekend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and great discussion. Good to talk with everyone.
All right. Well, talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.